Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1048, interview number 17 with Jin DiGiamio about Destiny Betrayed. This is being recorded on January 15th of the year 2019, Martin Luther King's birthday. And once again, it is my pleasure and a privilege to bring back to our airwaves Jin DiGiamio, the author of, among other titles, The Triumphal Destiny Betrayed, which is the focal point of our discussion in this program and has been for weeks running. Jim, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Good evening, Dave. Nice to be here.
We are now getting to the trial of Clay Shaw after 16 hours of build-up to that. And I think the attention we have devoted to the material is warranted by your book. You titled the chapter, at least the first one, Anticlimax. And I think that is appropriate, as I have stated both on and off the air. I think the single most important part of your Destiny Betrayed book is the delineation, the very pedantic highlighting of the synthesis of the CIA/intelligence community, the infiltrations into Jim Garrison's investigation, the media hatchet people who deliberately distorted Jim Garrison's investigation and at the same time sought to perjure witnesses and pervert their testimony, often under using severe coercion, and the actual criminal justice system itself, not only Ramsey Clark, the highest-ranking judicial official in the U.S., but also Clay Shaw's defense team. And as I said in the past, in terms of conceptual presentation, we have done those, we have set those forth in individual categories, and yet that is, frankly, something of an artificial construct, because they are all working together in this fascus, this bundle of sticks bound together by leather. And so I think, given what was ranged against Jim Garrison, the trial itself was an anticlimax. And as Tommy Bowndler, one of Guy Bannister's investigators, noted, federal power would never allow a conviction of Clay Shaw or anyone else. And I'm paraphrasing slightly. And, of course, they did not. Jim, what do you think? I think at some point, a restating, maybe when we get into the trial, a restating of the significance of the Clay Shaw versus aliases Clay Bertrand and Clem Bertrand is important, I think, to refresh. Do you think that would be a good thing to do at the top of the interview, or maybe wait till we get into people like Regis Kennedy and Aloysius Haddock, of course, that's all?
Well, I think we should wait to that, because I think the Regis Kennedy thing is kind of important in that regard. The reason I labeled that chapter Anticlimax is because, as I write in the opening pages, the delay between when Garrison indicted Shaw to when the trial began was nearly 2 years. And as I write in that chapter, almost all the delays, the vast majority of the delays, were initiated by Shaw's defense team. Okay, and I think it's very obvious why they did this. It's because it gave their many allies, which, as I illustrate in the book, this would be the CIA, the Justice Department, Wackenhut, which I think is in some ways a cutout for the FBI, all right, and locally, people like Aaron Cohn, All right. And later on, the two local newspapers, because as I wrote in my book, and a guy that you mentioned, Tommy Baumler, who had been an infiltrator for Guy Bannister and later became a lawyer in New Orleans, he did a very revealing interview with Harold Weisberg. And as you noted, he said, Shaw will never be punished. Because he said that he knew for a fact the CIA had sent in a guy into the city to go ahead and work the media beat. Because even though Garrison had been blasted by the national news media, all right, he still had a good reputation inside the city. Well, the CIA went ahead and sent in a guy to go ahead and change that around. And one of the things that they did is they initiated one of the infiltrators in Garrison's camp, William Gervich, to go over to the New Orleans States item, and that was the one outlet that Garrison still had, because WDSU, the local NBC affiliate, was against him, and the New Orleans Times-Picayune was already against him. All right, but the States item still gave him some good coverage. Well, after this guy, after Gervich visited with the editor-in-chief of that newspaper, the two good reporters they had on the Garrison beat, one of them being Ross Yockey, okay, were removed from the Garrison beat, okay? And I interviewed Ross Yockey later, and he told me, yes, I recall that distinctly, and I was assigned to doing high school football games, okay, after that. So this is how pervasive the influence of Washington was in making sure that Garrison was pretty much isolated. Now, the other thing that these guys did, the CIA also turned around witness testimony. In my book, I mentioned this guy named Thomas Moran, who was a backup witness to seeing Clay Shaw at the VIP room. This was a kind of a drinking area for frequent flyers at the New Orleans airport. You know, and he had seen Clay Shaw there, all right? And he recalled that Shaw had used the name Bertrand when he signed in, okay? And so the CIA heard about this to their local representative, Hunter Leak, who was the chief of the New Orleans station, all right? And he was assigned to go ahead and talk Moran out of his story, which he did. Moran took back his story later on. And I also note in the book that we have certain documents from the Garrison Group, all right, in which it is actually written that certain people will be assigned tasks in relation, okay, to the CIA's attack on Jim Garrison.
And the Garrison Group very quickly is the CIA task force, in effect, that was designated to administer the Garrison situation.
Right, right. Because if you recall, Helms originally said that we're going to have to organize this Garrison Group as a way of neutralizing his attacks on us before, during, and after the trial. So this went on, of course, as I'm talking about things that happened before the trial, but as the trial went on, as it was beginning, as jurors were being interviewed, James Angleton was running their names through a database to get information on the jury. James Angleton, of course, was the chief of counterintelligence at the CIA, all right? And then the CIA had Hunter Leak was going ahead and subscribing to both newspapers, the States Item and the Times-Picayune, before the trial, sending all the information to CIA headquarters. But then, as the trial began, he actually moved the ticker tape into the office and was getting, you know, reports from the courtroom that he was transmitting to Langley directly as the trial was ongoing. Okay? So this is what I mean about Helms's orders, okay, being carried out. All right? The CIA had wall-to-wall coverage on everything that was going on there. You know, and it wasn't just them. It was also the Department of Justice under Ramsey Clark, which went ahead and put together this medical review. And they had done this in 1968, but they didn't announce it until 69 at the beginning of the jury interviews for the Clay Shaw trial. So now only someone very innocent, you know, or very biased would not say that that was not a coincidence. It wasn't a coincidence. All right? It was there in order to go ahead and say that, look, the government has reviewed these autopsy materials. We've come to the same conclusion as the Warren Commission did. All right, it was two shots from behind, and that was it. There wasn't a conspiracy.
One of the people who sort of embodied the synthesis that was ranged against Garrison, we've talked about him many times before, was Gordon Novell, CIA, Bay of Pigs veteran, working with Mitch Rubel, electronics expert. And he infiltrated Garrison's office, became chief of security, was doing so for Alan Dulles, and bugging him for the FBI. And then you mentioned he was networking at one point with 17 different journalists. So that in addition to the cloak and dagger kind of stuff, electronic cloak and dagger, he was also functioning as a high-profile negative PR guy to smear Garrison.
Mm-hmm. Correct. The CIA clearly had linked him up with some of their paid journalists. And he was getting a lot of negative stories into the press about, you know, how bad the Garrison prosecution of Clay Shaw was. Now, if you don't recall this, I try to do a good job on this in my book. The constant negative press that Garrison got in this time period, and as anybody who has studied the workings of the CIA or the FBI will know, this is a very important part of how they work. It's called propaganda, all right? And what they can do, of course, is they can influence public opinion in a very strong way, one way or the other, all right, determining on how they feel about an issue, all right? And they can completely saturate the coverage of a person or event. And so this is what they did with Jim Garrison, all right? And this made it easier to excuse some of the weird things that were happening to Garrison's prosecution of Clay Shaw. For example, the constant turning down of extradition requests. Like, Garrison, up until Garrison took on the Kennedy case, he had been one of the best DAs in the country. He had a very good record as far as reversals of cases and also on extradition requests. Never had one turned down. Okay? But see, what happened now is it became much easier to go ahead and turn down these requests because of this drumbeat obligato that somehow Garrison was a rogue prosecutor and that Clay Shaw was Mr. Clean. You know, he was one of the angels, and nobody should even suspect that somehow he had been involved in a plot to kill JFK. All right, so this all worked hand in glove. And like another thing that I noted in the book is that this was, I believe, probably the first time that the CIA exposed itself in its domestic operations against a target in a similar way to what they would do overseas all the time. You know, this is the way, this is what they do to people overseas that they don't like. You know, they go ahead and they infiltrate their offices. They go ahead and they tar and feather them in the press. And as we'll see later, they then try and throw them in jail in order to discredit them. Well, that's what happened here. And we didn't see, the thing is, up until really the declassifications of the ARB, we really could not fill in all this background like I did in the book, all right, simply because we could only, you know, do a little hedging, a little jumping around, a little assumption, because not only did the CIA do this through its press assets and broadcast assets, but a lot of the literature on the Garrison case, you know, the only book that I recall on the actual trial of Clay Shaw was a very bad book by a guy named James Kirkwood, who went on to be a famous playwright and novelist, who was a friend of Clay Shaw's, rather long book, 650 pages. But that book was commissioned by Clay Shaw, and Shaw and Kirkwood were friends. And so that was a completely one-sided, terrible, you know, very stupid and biased book that completely distorted everything that went on and left so much of the story out that it was kind of ridiculous. But that was one of the things that Helms was going for when he said before, during, and after the trial.
Absolutely. Okay? Absolutely.
So what happened is that we didn't get any of the stuff I have in the book until Oliver Stone's movie came out, and then that went ahead and started up the Assassinations Record Review Board. And now we have all the documentation, although we don't have all of it. We have a good portion of it where we could now prove the things that we always suspected were happening.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the last week we read an article from the Huffington Post from the fall of 2016 that echoed all of the nonsense from James Kirkwood, James Phelan, and others. And so this is what young people have been told about what happened. And in particular, the Rodney Wilson piece repeated the canard that Garrison was some sort of power-mad homophobe, and that poor Clay Shaw, the gay Wilsonian / FDR liberal, and he was gay, but he was no Wilsonian or FDR liberal.
That's a remnant of, that's how powerful that impression was.
Absolutely.
Okay? You know, that people like that are still, you know, going ahead and trying to advance it, you know, in this day and age when we have, you know, it's incredible. We've made a quantum leap now forward.
Absolutely.
Okay, with our understanding of what happened to Jim Garrison, thanks to the ARB. But there's still people like that, you know, that will go ahead and still try and raise the bloody shirt, so to speak. And, you know, it's very disappointing, Dave, because a lot of people, including myself, when the whole revolution in online journalism was beginning, you know, around 1998, 2000, 2002, 2005, we thought that there'd be a new day, you know, in journalism. And to have the Huffington Post go ahead and still print a crappy article like that is very disappointing.
Well, and you know, the thing is, Jim, that Rodney Wilson, the fellow who wrote the article, and this is not necessarily to speak against him, I've never heard of him, but what they're really doing is they are parroting an already established meme. You know, so the really, well, the most, as I've said before, including earlier, I think the most important part of your very important book is showing how the intelligence community and the media and the criminal justice system are synthesized. They are forged into a hammer of repression, and they then beat the designated target out flat on the anvil of justice, quote-unquote, and, quote, journalism, unquote. And it is so important. You know, one of the things that needs to be said in that context. A couple of weeks ago, I read into the record Fred Lemus, who was the climactic witness in spook/journalist Walter Sheridan's hit piece on Garrison on NBC. And he, in 1969, submitted an affidavit in which he stated in no uncertain terms that he had been threatened with harm, his family had been threatened with harm, and he was also directly approached by Irving Diamond, according to the affidavit, to perjure himself and assured by Diamond that if, in fact, Garrison charged him with perjury, that Diamond could guarantee there would be attorneys available to defend him against that. The threats directed at Fred Lemus should be seen, on the one hand, against the background of what happened to people like Guy Bannister, Bannister investigators Hugh Ward, and Maurice Brooks Gatman, what happened to David Ferry, what happened to Eladio Del Valle, and many others. They basically bit the dust. And also what was being done to Garrison witnesses. I'd like you, Jim, before I read the stunning second paragraph of page 294 from your book, I'd like you to synopsize who each of these people is or was, so the audience knows their significance for the investigation. Richard Case Nagel, about whom we've spoken before.
Oh, a very important witness, because Nagel was commissioned by the KGB office down in Mexico to seek out and find the plot they had heard of that was in the works right then to go ahead and try and kill President Kennedy, because they feared, very justly in retrospect, that it would be used as a tool to smear the KGB. All right? And Nagel, of course, had several months of work. He had detected the same plot that Garrison had found out, that on the base level, or as they say, the ground level, that people like Bannister and Ferry were involved in the maneuvering of Oswald. All right, so he was a very, very important witness. Unfortunately, while in New York, a moving car went by him. Guy threw a hand grenade at him. All right, miraculously, Nagel survived. He collected the debris of the hand grenade, brought it back to Garrison's office, and said, "I don't think it's a good idea for me to testify."
No, I think that could be very, very persuasive indeed. Jim, who was Clyde Johnson?
Clyde Johnson was another very interesting witness. Clyde Johnson was one of these fundamentalist preachers, okay, down in the South. One of his places was in New Orleans, and he was like most of these guys are, okay, he was a rather conservative kind of a person who didn't really care that much for JFK, all right? And so he met up at a meeting later, all right, with a guy he later identified as Clay Shaw. And Clay Shaw was with a guy named, he called Jack Rubion. All right? And so he went ahead and identified for Garrison those two people as the people that he met up with. All right? And so this, of course, very interesting, because what Shaw was telling them, I want you to keep on hammering away at Kennedy, okay, from New Orleans, And my hope is that if you keep this up and if it attracts press coverage, Kennedy will be forced to come down here and defend himself. All right? And so when Garrison heard about this, this, of course, is very, very important testimony. He decided that Johnson was such an important witness, all right, that he was going to hide him out on the eve of the trial. And so he did. And he put him in some obscure college outside the city in a college dorm. Now, to show you just how infiltrated Garrison's office was, very, very few people in the office knew the name of the college and the building that Johnson was at. But somehow, they found him. And they beat the living daylights out of this guy, you know, to the point that he couldn't testify. He was in the hospital.
Sure, sure. And bear in mind that Gordon Novell was bugging the office on behalf of both CIA and
FBI. Well, that might have been how they found out about it, through electronic surveillance.
It also might have been Tom Bethel took Garrison's witness list and gave it to Clay Shaw's defense. So
that's another thing that happened on the eve of the trial.
Yeah.
See, Tom Bethel was the guy who was keeping the archives for Garrison, all right? And so that would mean, of course, all the paper documents. So he knew exactly what the hell was going on the eve of the trial. And they had prepared a complete trial brief, which listed every single one of their witnesses and what they were going to testify to, all right? So you're right, that might have been one of the ways that they found out about Johnson. But anyway, to finish that story, Bethel defected on the eve of the trial, turned over the whole thing to Shaw's lawyers.
Yeah.
And you know? In other words, Shaw's lawyers knew everything that Garrison was going to do.
Absolutely.
Okay? But Garrison he couldn't have asked for a mistrial, but he thought that this would be another excuse for them to delay the trial another year. Okay, so he just went ahead and tried the case anyway.
Yeah. Jim, tell us who we'll get to him when we actually get to the legal proceedings themselves. I guess one might say these are the illegal proceedings themselves.
Yes, right.
Aloysius Habeckhorst. Who was he?
Habeckhorst was a policeman who was a booking agent the night that Garrison indicted Clay Shaw. All right? And so, as standard booking procedure, you go ahead and fingerprint the guy, and then you ask him if he uses any aliases. And he fingerprinted him, asked him to use any aliases, and he said Clay Bertrand. And Habeckhorst wrote it down. Okay?
And this is the booking officer booking
right.
Clay Shaw. So this is an actual legal proceeding.
Correct. All right. And so when the next day, and this shows you what a good witness Habeckhorst was, the next day he's watching television with his wife, and one of the reporters says one of the keystones of the case is that Garrison says that Shaw is Clay Bertrand. And his wife told me that when Habeckhorst heard that, he jumped out of his chair, turned to her and said, "That's what he told me. That's what I wrote down." Okay, that the alias was Bertrand.
Yep.
So he goes down and he tells Garrison this information. Well, before he was supposed to testify, all right, Garrison was fine. He was learning slowly. Okay, he put surveillance on Habeckhorst to protect him. Okay, but his wife told me that someone called him 2 days. Somebody called his house 2 days before and said, "Is Al there?" And she said, "No." And she said she was suspicious already because his close friends called him by his nickname, which was Hot Seat,
mm-hmm.
All right? And he said, "Do you know when he'll be home?" And she said, "He's not going to be home till late." Well, Garrison took the protection off him because he was on a detail with other policemen. But when he went home the night before he was supposed to testify, a pickup truck pulled out of an alley and sideswiped him. Okay? All right? Obviously, it was meant to do more than that, but he jumped out of the way at the last minute. And so when he went to the trial the next day, there's a picture of him. He had to wear sunglasses because he had facial injuries. All right? Mm-hmm. But the worst part of it is that the judge, Haggerty, decided not to let him testify in front of the jury. He cleared the court, all right, and put the jury in their chambers, and he said that he doubted Habercourse's testimony. Now, this is really bizarre because, like I said, Habercourse didn't even know that this was an important part of Garrison's case against Clay Shaw.
We should also mention that Habercourse had an excellent record as a New Orleans cop.
Yes, right.
It wasn't
actually made training films with Habercourse. Okay.
He was the guy.
You know, it doesn't get much better than that, does it?
They think
much of him that he's training other officers with films, watching him do stuff in films, you know. And he was getting a lot of certificates of merit by that time also, all right? And so the judge went ahead and decreed that Habercourse would not be allowed to testify in front of the jury. And Garrison tried to appeal that ruling, okay? But it didn't work. Now, later on, through an interview I did, I found out that the reason for this might have been that Habercourse had, let us call it, a wayward brother, okay, who had gotten into trouble with the law previously and had appeared before Haggerty. You know, why that would reflect on Aloysius is something I don't understand. His brother, I almost got to interview his brother, but at the last minute he backed out. Okay, of doing the interview.
The point being, Jim, let me interject briefly. I want to get your synopsis of some other witnesses here before I read paragraph 2 from 294. Here, again, we have the synthesis of the intel community, and they are working with Clay Shaw's defense team, and they are perverting at the activity of a good New Orleans cop, Aloysius Habercourse, who was the booking officer, who when he booked Clay Shaw, he said, do you use any aliases? Clay Shaw says Clay Bertrand, which was fundamental to the investigation of Jim Garrison. And then Aloysius Habercourse's truck is rammed the day before he is to testify.
No, a pickup truck pulled out of an alley and rammed him.
Okay, a truck rammed his car the day before he was going to testify. And then in the trial itself, the judge refuses to allow the testimony of a good New Orleans cop who was the booking officer who, in the legal proceeding of booking Clay Shaw, had Clay Shaw give him the alias Clay Bertrand, which was fundamental to Garrison's investigation. Again, the synthesis of the intel community, the media, Clay Shaw's defense team, and the raw mailed fist. Before I read a little bit about the mailed fist, tell us who Edwin McGehee was, or McGehee.
Okay, Edwin McGehee was one of the witnesses that Garrison had brought down from the Clinton-Jackson area, all right? And he was the barber who Oswald first went to visit in that area, all right? Gave him a haircut and inquired about a job at the Jackson State Hospital. And McGehee said, well, it would probably help you if you went and talked to the state representatives, Reeves Morgan. And so Oswald then went to talk to Reeves Morgan. And he was at his house at night, and his two kids were there. He had a son and a daughter, Mary and Van. All right? And Morgan referred him to, well, maybe he should register to vote in the area. And both Van and Mary Morgan, Mary Morgan testified that it was Oswald. Van said that he was playing in the front yard, and there was a guy with a shock of white hair in a big black limousine type of car who was waiting for Oswald, all right, when he came out. All right, so that's pretty good testimony that Shaw was driving the car, because several witnesses identified Sean Ferry when Oswald went to register to vote the next day. All right. And so what happens is that Morgan, when after he testified, he had a prowler on his premises, okay, when he got back, reported him to the cops. The cops apprehended him, and he said, I need to make one phone call. And he goes, where? He goes, International Trademark.
I presume that was... You're right. That was actually Edwin McGahey, the other Clinton.
Oh, that was McGee. Okay, yeah. Excuse me.
Now, of course,
all right,
the
that was the barber.
The head of the International Trademark was Clay Shaw.
So then it's Morgan who got his window blown out by a gun?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
had the window shot
right
out of his truck. And we should also recall that when Lee Harvey Oswald booked his passage to Europe, the quote defect, unquote,
right,
to the Soviet Union, he booked it through the International Trademark. So
right,
it is really
right,
interesting what happened. Let me read paragraph 2 from page 294. And again, the synthesis of the intel community, the infiltrators in the garrison's investigation, the media, and Clay Shaw's defense team and the Justice Department functioning in an altogether criminal fashion, with a capital C and a capital F. You know, in a past interview, we mentioned that John J. McCoy, he said that it was important that the U.S. not be seen as a banana republic. And yet we have the following from page 294. Before and during the trial, Garrison's witnesses were being surveilled, harassed, and physically attacked. For instance, Richard Case Nagel had a grenade thrown at him from a speeding car in New York. Nagel brought the remains of the grenade to Garrison and told him he did not think it wise for him to testify at Shaw's trial. Even though Garrison had spirited Clyde Johnson out of town and very few people knew where he was, the FBI's total surveillance evidently paid off. He was brutally beaten on the eve of the trial and hospitalized. Aloysius Habeghorst, the man who booked Shaw and heard him say his alias was Bertrand, was rammed by a truck the day before he testified. After he testified, Edwin McGahey found a prowler on his front lawn. He called the marshal, and the man was arrested. At the station, the man asked to make one phone call. The call he made was to the International Trademark. After he testified, Reeves Morgan had the windows shot out of his truck. What makes all this violent witness intimidation more startling is what Robert Tannenbaum stated to the author in an interview for Probe magazine. Parenthetically, that is the publication that you and Lisa Peace generated.
Right.
He said that he had seen a set of documents that originated in the office of Richard Helms. They revealed that the CIA was monitoring and harassing Garrison's witnesses. So in the end, this is the kind of thing that prevailed in the Garrison investigation. And as at one level almost funny, and exemplifying what Nietzsche said when he said that a joke is the epigram on the death of a feeling, it is outrageous. And yet I think for most people, when they hear something like this, Jim, it just scares the humor what out of them. And, you know, justifiably so. I mean, who the hell would want to stick their nose into something like this? There are people who say, you know, oh, I don't believe in conspiracy theories. Somebody throws a goddamn hand grenade at them, they'll believe in conspiracy theories. You know, that'll do it for you. You know, something I've said many times over the decades that I've been on the air, we basically are beset by two types of Nazis in this country. There are the Nazis, but even worse than they are the NOT-SEES Nazis, the ones who will not see. And I think that one of the things your book has done is to make it much more difficult for the Nazis to keep the NOT-SEES to keep up their pretense. We have mentioned.
See, this is why I say I labeled that chapter an anticlimax.
Yeah.
Because Garrison's case was so crippled by the time the opening witness, you know, took the stand, that it was almost a foregone conclusion what was going to happen.
Yeah.
You know? And so you if you take away Habeckhorst, if you take away Johnson, if you take away Nagel, those are all very important and key witnesses, you know, to what Garrison was trying to prove. You know, and so it was a very shattering blow to have that happen. And at the same time, Shaw's lawyers knew everything he was going to do. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, not to belabor the point, but the synthesis of the agency and other intel agencies, the agency and the bureau, the infiltrators in the Garrison's office, the major media and the hatchet people specifically recruited to smear Garrison and Clayshaw's defense team and the highest, the legal, the judicial machinery going to the highest levels of people like Ramsey Clark, and as we will see in a moment, his successor, John Mitchell, as Attorney General under Richard Nixon. That formidable engine was what crushed Jim Garrison. And, you know, people may have seen the movie The Godfather, where the one guy gets the severed horse head in his bed. So many of Garrison's witnesses, as we have just seen on page 294, got that same kind of treatment. One thing you mentioned, Jim, is you write about many things. Have you heard, I know on one page, a fellow named Francis Giordano, who was an associate of Carlos Marcello, introduced Garrison introduced someone to Judge Hagerty. Have you unearthed anything about Hagerty having some interesting connections, or I'm just wondering?
No, that's the only instance I found.
Okay. All right. Very good.
Okay.
We should also mention briefly.
But I should say one thing in Hagerty's defense.
Sure.
He didn't believe Shaw. He told a guy who went down there, a researcher named Ed Tatro, all right, Ed Tatro went down to watch a trial from Boston, and he struck up a friendship with Hagerty. And Hagerty later said that he told Ed that, you know, look at this evidence, this written evidence of this Bertrand guy signing the register, you know. And he later said in an interview that he thought that Shaw conned the jury. All right? So why he did what he did in the Habeckhorst instance is even more mysterious if he didn't believe that Shaw was telling the truth. And, of course, he was right, as I write in the book. You know, Clay Shaw told at least four lies on the stand, okay, that he was never associated with the CIA, which, oh, my God, we have so much evidence on that today.
You bet.
That it's preposterous.
Sure.
Okay, all right, that somehow that he had never been the Clinton-Jackson area when we had at least eight witnesses who identified him, you know, as being up there. Okay, that he did not know David Ferry. I mean, that is so ridiculous. You know, even the FBI and the CIA had reports that Ferry had been seen in Shaw's office at the International Trade Mart.
Sure.
That he did not know Oswald. That, I mean, come on. if you add up all the witnesses in the Clinton-Jackson area, who, by the way, did we go over that at all?
We covered that in an earlier interview, and I should recall briefly for the listeners that both Edwin McGahee, whom we just discussed, having the prowler on his lawn, then when the guy gets arrested, he places a call to the International Trademark run by Clay Shaw, and then also Reeves Morgan, who had the windows to his truck shop out after he testified, were two of the many witnesses who linked Clay Shaw. We spoke about Clinton, why Oswald was going to be registered.
Okay, we did talk about it then, so people will understand what I'm saying.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Yeah, there were at least, in addition to the witnesses that Garrison produced at the trial, there were at least 12 other witnesses, okay, who saw Ferry and Shaw escorting Oswald around up there. So the idea that Shaw did not know Oswald, and there was another witness that I talk about in the book who did some work for Clay Shaw, because Shaw was a real estate renovator in the French Quarter. You know, he said he accidentally walked in one of these homes that Shaw was restoring, and he saw Shaw with Ferry and Oswald there in the summer of 1963, you know. And then there's also the Dean Andrews thing, I think we talked about.
We did.
In which he said to Harold Weisberg secretly that he knew that Shaw was Bertrand and that Shaw called him up to go to Dallas to defend Oswald. So the idea that somehow Shaw did not know Oswald, Shaw did not know Ferry, Shaw never worked for the CIA, and he was not. This is all perjury. Okay, and the reason that Shaw felt he could get away with it, because he was getting so much help from Washington.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. It reminds me again of the old saying minted by Dr. Johnson. It can be truly said that treason doth never succeed, because when it doth succeed, none dare call it treason.
And, correct.
We have seen that. And, you know, bearing in mind this enormous engine, again, forgive me, listeners, the synthesis of the intel community, intel papers in the Garrison's investigation, the major news media, Clay Shaw's defense, and the highest echelons of the legal defense system into an irresistible, annihilating engine. And when all else fails, then, you know, the mailed fist comes out, and you get a hand grenade thrown at you, that the trial was a foregone conclusion. In an earlier...
Oh, here's a quote that illustrates what I just said.
Go ahead.
This is by Carlos Bringier. Mm-hmm. Okay? Garrison had something big. High persons were involved in the assassination conspiracy. Shaw felt confident because he knew that these high persons would have to defend him.
And, of course, Carlo Bringier, one of the anti-Castro Cubans involved with that famous WDSU interview. And our listeners have actually heard, I've played it many times over the year, conversation carte blanche with Ed Butler. You have Oswald, you have Carlos Bringier, and at one point Bringier reads a newspaper clipping and to Oswald and says in his speech and such and such, Fidel Castro called John F. Kennedy a ruffian and a thief. Do you agree with Mr. Castro setting up Oswald to be killed? That's in many of the shows that we've had. Keeping in mind what we've talked about, in the trial itself, poor Perry Russo eventually bowed beneath this yoke that was placed on the criminal justice system.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Tell us about the perversion. We got about 10 minutes left in this interview, Jim, about Perry Russo's perverted testimony.
Well, see, Russo had been gone at now for about 2 years. And the guy who was targeting Russo was James Phelan, okay? And when Russo first surfaced, I found the guy who actually went to Baton Rouge to interview Russo with Phelan. He was a famous photographer back then, a freelance photographer, who sometimes worked for Saturday Evening Post. His name was Matt Heron. And when I tracked down Matt Heron, he told me that, you know, when we first interviewed him, Russo was very strong, you know, that this was really, they were actually talking about, you know, killing JFK that night, you know, and they had all, you know, they mapped it all out, you know, talked about how they were getting away, et cetera. And it was pretty much, you know, they were going to kill. Now, what happened, of course, is after the battering he took in the press and the idea that somehow all this had been drugged into him, you know, by hypnosis, you know, and the sodium pentothal, you know, that eventually got to him. He had been pilloried in the press. He had lost his job, all right, and he would not sell out to Walter Sheridan, who promised him a new life in California. And after this, he actually said on the stand, when Irvin Diamond, Shaw's lead lawyer, said, "Doesn't this have all the earmarks of a BS session?" And he said, "Yeah." Okay? And that really dissipated, you know, the force of his testimony. But what's interesting about that, though, is that James Phelan said that Matt Heron would stand up for him by saying that Russo did not mention Shaw in Baton Rouge when Phelan went up to see him. And so Diamond put out a warrant for Matt Heron, but guess what? Matt Heron never testified at the trial. That's because when I talked to Matt Heron, he told me the opposite of what Phelan had said about Russo. He did mention Clay Shaw as Bertrand under the at that first meeting. So this is the kind of psychological warfare that was being used against Garrison and his witnesses, and of course through the public, because as we know, Phelan every day had rented a house, and he was tapping out what the next day's headlines were going to be, you know, including what was going to be the message about the Zapruder film.
Yep.
All right. Okay, so
calling Jim, that James Phelan was one of the primary media hatchet men. He was working directly with the intelligence community, working directly
right.
with Clay Shaw's defense team, and as we will see in our next interview, actually took the witness stand on behalf, you know, of Clay Shaw during the trial
right.
itself. He embodies that synthesis that I have referred to so many times. Go ahead. And by the way, Perry Russo initially sort of had the impression, as we spoke about in an earlier interview, that this might have just been some loose talk. But then when David Ferry talked about how he was going to be, I think, at East Hampton State, Louisiana campus or something in Hampton, Louisiana, and then Clay Shaw said he would be on the
Compton,
west,
Louisiana.
Compton, that was it. And
yeah.
then Clay Shaw said he would be in San Francisco.
Yes.
Then, which is exactly where each of them was. Perry Russo realized that this was not a bull session. This was a strategy session.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And so what I – clearly somebody got to Russo, and probably the battering that he took for all that time, you know. And I talked to Russo later on, I think, two occasions. And – he decided that he just didn't want to have anything more to do with it after the trial. He did not want to testify for Garrison at the perjury trial, all right? And he sort of denounced the whole thing in a private tape with Irvin Diamond so that Garrison could not call him. His life had basically, he ended up being a cab driver, you know, in New Orleans, all right? And so that's what happened, you know, and so they, this is a number of ways they have to get to you, you know, like Charlie Schumer said about Trump, you know, you don't mess with the intelligence community in Washington. They have about 8 ways to Sunday of nailing you. Okay.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Absolutely. And the, you know, Perry Russo's change of mind can be viewed against that mailed fist that was brought out against, you know, Aloysius Habeckhorst, Richard K. Sagel, right. Clive Johnson, Edwin McGahee, Reeves Morgan, and that in turn against the tapestry of what happened to Bannister, Eladio Del Valle, Hugh Ward, Maurice Brooks Scatman, David Ferry, and so many other witnesses who bit the dust, so to speak. It really is altogether intimidating. Jim, I'm this is a bit of brief editorialization. We've got 5 minutes, so a little under 5 minutes. I'm in my 40th year on the air, and I think back when I started at the age of 30, and speaking strictly for myself, some people may be an adult at 30, but, if I wasn't a kid, I was sure as hell naive. You know, I really believed in this country. You know, we hold these truths to be self-evident and all that stuff. And boy, did I have an education ahead of me. And your book brought it to yet another level, you know, in terms of actually delineating how our political and legal system are perverted at a fundamental level. And again, that synthesis that I've alluded to so many times, really the essence of that perversion. And you deserve a lot of credit for doing that. And we will be getting into the trial proceedings themselves, which are more than a little interesting. We've got a couple of minutes left here, Jim. Tell us, people might very well want to find out more. How can they order Destiny Betrayed? How can they order JFK The Evidence Today? Tell them about that, about your website and Black Op Radio.
All right. I have a website which I maintain, and it's called KennedysandKing.com. And there you can order either one of my most recent books, which is the one under discussion, Destiny Betrayed. All right, and then that's the second edition of that book. And then the other one, the more recent book, is the JFK Assassination, The Evidence Today. I also am a semi-regular on Leno Sanek's show, Black Op Radio, out of Vancouver, which is broadcast on Thursday nights. He's kind of a little guy compared to Dave. He's only been on for about 20 years. You know, Dave has been on for twice as long. But they're both fighting the good fight.
So there is where people can learn more. I would note that your website is Kennedys and King, and today is actually Martin Luther King's birthday. We observe the holiday on Monday, next Monday, the 21st of January, but his actual physical birthday was on January 15th, and this past April 4th of 2018, I did a 12-hour show memorializing the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's assassination, and he was basically felled by the same forces. And there are some profound evidentiary tributaries running between the two assassinations. So that when Jim relates his website as being Kennedy's and King, that has a large significance for us. In our next interview, we're going to get into more of the actual trial proceedings, and I think that will be eye-opening for people who are not familiar with those proceedings. This, however, concludes For the Record program number 1048, interview number 17 with Jim DiGiamio about Destiny Betrayed. This is being recorded on January 15th, yes, of the year 2019. For Jim DiGiamio, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.